Okay, a very, very different perspective. It shows up in the Rambam in the Marei Nevuchim. So the Rambam says, and here you have my English translation of one or another Hebrew version of the Arabic. Among the things that you likewise ought to know is that the Torah does not consider the isolated individual, and the command was not given with a view to the minority of cases. Rather, in everything that it is desirable to accomplish, be it an outlook or a character trait, or an action that is effective, only the things that are a majority are considered, and no attention is paid to something that rarely occurs, nor to the damage that will occur to an individual human because of that decree in Torah governance. This is a very strong, and often people find this a shocking passage, because Ramban is describing biblical literature. And he says, when the Torah has a command, you should know, the Torah, when it gives this command, is not interested in what will happen some of the time, but only what will happen most of the time. And it's not interested in what will happen to individual human beings. It's interested in what will happen to the overall class. Why? Because the Torah is a divine thing. And therefore, you can learn about it from natural things, where the general utilities found in them include and necessarily entail private damages, as has been explained in our words and the words of others. So God creates tides, and tides are a good thing, but sometimes tides lead to tsunamis. Tsunamis are a very bad thing for a whole limited group of people. That's okay. Right? That's okay. All the forces of nature are really good for humanity as a whole. Right? They will make our life possible. The context of nature is what makes our life possible.
It's not by nature.
He says that you can learn about the Torah from nature, just like nature is good, even though sometimes people are struck by lightning. And you could say, God, why did you create the world with this cool electrical stuff? Sometimes that's going to lead to people being struck by lightning. When God created the world, he wasn't interested about individual people struck by lightning. And the Torah is God's mind, just like the world is God's mind. So guess what? If you follow the Torah, some people are going to get struck by lightning. And that is inherent in the nature of Torah. And in case you don't believe him, he goes on, right? He says, on the basis of this distinction, you should not be astonished that the purposes of the Torah are not fulfilled in every individual. Rather, it follows necessarily that there will be people whom that Torah governance does not bring to perfection, as the forms of natural species do not achieve all that necessarily follows them from them in each individual member of the species. For everything comes from one deity and one actor, given from one shepherd, and the reverse of this is impossible. We have already explained that the impossible has a fixed nature that will never change. So if he tells you, you know what, you're going to find people, they are really, really frum, and they're bad people. Their character doesn't improve. They're not healthy. And in general, you look at them and you say, well, it's a Navel Bershus HaTorah. That's okay. Because the nature of the Torah is that it's a divine document, and divine documents deal with divine, just like God created the world in generalities, right? So that it would be good for most people most of the time. So too, he created the Torah, so it would be good for most people most of the time. He goes on to say, yeah, those such people are bad people. Yeah, they're exactly right. Exactly right. All true. But there are going to be people like that. And the fact that there are people like that doesn't mean that Torah is wrong. Doesn't prove the divinity, right? There are going to be people like that because, right, people who follow Torah and end up becoming, you know, ritualistic automatons with no sense of ethics are struck by lightning. Right? That's what happened. Without any invidious comments about people who are struck by lightning in specific places on the roads to specific places. In any case, some of you got that. So furthermore, on the basis of this distinction, it would not be proper for the commandments to be influenced by the changing conditions of human beings and the times, in the way that the preparation of medicine is influenced. This is a lot of fun because here the Rambam reverses modern categories. We tend to think of Western medicine is objective and doesn't take into account the individual patient, whereas we think religion is supposed to be very specific. So the Rambam says that, no, actually, it is medicine
that is supposed to be formulated in accordance with the mix of humors in every person, and so there's no such thing as a standard prescription. Every prescription has to be adjusted for the individual patient, which is what we now call Eastern medicine. If you want to plug, you can read The Web That Has No Weaver, which is a really good book about Eastern medicine and how it connects to this. It was very helpful to me in understanding the Ted Kapchuk, who was also a very cool person. It was very helpful for me in understanding what was going on in Rambam. Whereas he thinks law is supposed to be general. Law is supposed to be what we think of medicine now. Medicine is supposed to be what we think of as law now. Right? Medicine is supposed to be completely adjusted to the individual. Law is supposed to be very, very general. So in a different context, I have a shiur which I call Should Poskim Be Doctors of the Soul, in which I argue that what Rambam is talking about here is the law as it comes from legislators and not the law as it comes from judges. In the same way that the fact that God designed the world in such a way that some people would be struck by lightning and that wasn't something that God was directly concerned about when he constructed the world doesn't mean that we aren't supposed to go around putting up lightning rods if we think they actually work. Right, our job, right, and doctors are supposed to heal people, even though the laws of nature are set up in such ways that some people will catch horrible diseases, but we're okay healing them. So by the same token, Poskim, when confronted by cases in which the law is causing damage to individuals, so Poskim are supposed to put up lightning rods. So if you see somebody for whom, right, the unaltered, the unmediated effect of the law will be to turn them into Naval B'Shus HaTorah, so your job as a Posek is to try and put up a lightning rod and make sure they don't turn out that way. If you see a community that is about to be swept away by a tsunami, you're supposed to put up the halachic equivalent of seawall, if you think seawalls work for tsunamis, which I don't think they work very well at all. There's not much you can do about tsunamis, but you can do something about rising sea level. But fundamentally, what Rambam seems to be saying is that there is something about the nature of law that prevents it from being attuned to individuals, and therefore it might be, and this ties in with what Zifranath wanted to say in the Ramban, it might be that Rambam will say that there are areas that are not supposed to be turned into law because those are the areas where we think it would be better to allow things to be adjusted for individuals as opposed to treating everything as a class. So the areas which are left to be lifting Mishra Hadin are the things which for some people will be the best thing, but for other people will be damaging, and the percentage of people who will be damaged by making that an obligation is too great. And therefore we leave it open, and that ties into even the position, because even the people who hold kofina lifnei mishrat hadin will often believe they're only kofa the people who are on the level that they should do it to keep lifnei mishrat hadin. That at least is my teacher Rabbi Bleich's solution to many of these issues. That actually depending on how we evaluate your spiritual level, we compel you to do more and more. It's not that these things are optional, but they're optional, right? But the degree of obligation depends on the nature of the person you are, and that suggests that the difference between these spaces it's not really our experience, but it's an evaluation on the legal level that since law by its nature will always relate to classes and not to individuals, so you have to be very careful when you turn things into law. Right? Every law has a cost. There will always be some people for whom this law is spiritually damaging. Just like every law of nature has a choice. And then that becomes a paradigm, I think, for thinking about areas of halakha generally. One of the areas that we have not thought about enough in contemporary halakha is the costs of making things obligations. Part of it is just the loss of autonomy per se, that there's room and space for autonomy as such. But part of it is just that there are lots of things that are good for lots of people, but not for everyone. And we tend to, because of our desire to turn everything into law, so we end up legislating some people's religious sensibilities on everybody. And it might very well be there are things we could say, look, I really wish everyone wanted to do this. I really wish everyone, everybody was beneficial for I really wish that everyone did this and they got the right meaning of it. But instead of yelling at them because, you know what, this is your obligation and you're making it meaningless, we should say, oh, you know what, since that's going to be meaningless to most people, we shouldn't make it an obligation. Right? Do you think interesting ways in which we do that? Lamasa is talking about the how many piyutim you should say in Yom Tov davening. So we've kind of come to the realization, you know what, that the piyutim worked at a certain time; they don't work so well anymore in communities for whom the poetry is meaningless, and so we've cut it down. I think that's probably a very good decision, as opposed to continuing having us say them at great length and everyone bored out of their mind and yelling at them because they're not good at understanding medieval poetry. I myself wish that everyone, you know, I myself wish that we could find other genres of poetry. Since, you know, that on the whole, they sort of the alphabetical repetitive rhyming acrostics, whatever, don't do it for me as great, you know, as inspirational religious literature. And if I had my choice, there'd be a lot more Wallace Stevens. Okay. Some of you may have not be affected by Wallace Stevens at all. But you know, I tend to think that on lots of these days we could just read The Idea of Order at Key West and we would come out ahead if we were just looking for inspirational experiences. Okay, so that's another frame. So here's one more frame, which I think is really a useful frame. This is from a Harvard Law professor who I don't think is still alive. A book was published in 1964. Called Lon Fuller. I don't think he's alive, but could be wrong. And it was brought to my attention in a book by the Israeli scholar Benjamin Brown, in his work on the Chavetz Chaim. And I confess that, really, I know this through Dr. Brown. Then I was looking on the web now and trying to find the original and realized that I had not really adequately studied the original. So my understanding of it is probably going to be a melange of what Dr. Brown did with it and what Professor Fuller said originally. And you'll see if it makes sense or not. So here is Professor Fuller's actual words. The content of these chapters in the book he's putting out called The Morality of Law has been chiefly shaped by a dissatisfaction with the existing literature concerning the relation between law and morality. This should be familiar to us. Right? So is this sheer. This literature seems to be deficient in two important respects. The first of these relates to a failure to clarify the meaning of morality itself. Definitions of law we have in almost unwanted abundance. But when law is compared with morality, it seems to be assumed that everyone knows what the second term of the comparison embraces. Thomas Reed Powell used to say that if you can think about something that is related to something else without thinking about the something to which it is related, then you know how to think legally. So that's an interesting claim, and I think it's a fairly good description of the way much of the conversation has taken place, that we talk about halakha as opposed to something else, but really not so interested in defining the something else, which we sort of think, well, everyone sort of knows what the right thing to do is. And that's what the other stuff is. The other stuff is the right thing to do. But if we're trying to define halakha as opposed to other things, it might be that we actually have to define the other things. So in the present case, it seems to me, the legal mind generally exhausts itself in thinking about halakha, and its content to leave unexamined the thing to which halakha is being related and from which it is being distinguished. In my first chapter, an effort is made to redress this balance. This is done chiefly by emphasizing a distinction between what I call the morality of aspiration and the morality of duty. Okay, so those are the categories that he comes up with, the morality of aspiration and the morality of duty. Now, here's what I got from Professor Brown, and you can tell me if you think this is what he really means. I'm not sure anymore. What Professor Brown argues is that the Chafetz Chaim's work Shmirat HaLashon, thought of as a standard book of halakha in the way, let's say, the Shulchan Aruch is a category error. Because the Shulchan Aruch are the things that you have to do, whereas the Shmirat HaLashon is a book really about what you would like to be. Right, you would like to be the kind of person who makes the decision Shmirat HaLashon does. But nobody is. Nobody ever is. And if you all were, right? If one of you tries to be that in the real world,
then you probably are hopelessly unsuccessful socially, and you end up, you know, being betrayed and assassinated, and, you know, totally unaware of your surroundings. It doesn't, right? It doesn't work. You can't engage, right? You end up with these real stories where, you know, you're living in a society, but you're terrified of any actual human interaction because you're afraid that someone will tell you something of human interest. Right, so you celebrate when you can talk to when you can finally get on trains and talk to farmers as opposed to intellectuals, farmers with whom you have no prior relationship, because you know that they're going to talk about nothing but manure for hours. And that is your dream, to talk about nothing but manure for hours, because manure, right, you're pretty clear, unless you insult the quality of someone else's manure, you're pretty clear that you're not going to violate Hilchos Lashon Hara in the process. That's a very, you know, that's a difficult description of the ideal. Of the ideal life. Now, a society where everyone kept Shemirat HaLashon, that would be incredible. But, and I tell you, I ran this with one of my favorite GAN courses, a very atypical GAN course. I talk about this a lot. That I had a conversation with, I believe, Rabbi Mark Gottlieb and Professor Shalom Karmi about whether teaching halacha actually ever changed people. And my problem was that most attempts to change students are highly manipulative, and as I was I found it very problematic to teach things with the aim of changing people, because it seems very, very manipulative and not the way it should relate to students. But and many of the particularly having an argument about Musar teaching, and I found Musar teaching very problematic. It was almost always very, very manipulative. Say like the story. The story that had made a deep impression on me at that time, I was reading some book of great Musar highlights in Shul. And so one of the episodes that made a deep impact on me was about the Altar of Slobodka, who was really an astonishing pedagogic figure. And it tells you the story how the Altar of Slobodka was in the Beis Medrash, and there were two students of roughly equal ability. And when one of them came over to the altar, he would greet him effusively and talk to him at length. When the other one came over to the altar, he would always be cold and turn away, you know, and really never say anything to him. Flash forward 15, 20 years. The student whom the altar was always very cold to loses a parent and is sitting Shiva, and the altar shows up at his house and stays there all of Shiva and doesn't leave, talking the whole time. The student is very puzzled. At the end of it, finally, says, Rebbe, you know, I'm very grateful you stayed all this time, but why is it that all of a sudden now you're being effusive to me when in yeshiva you would never exchange words with me? And he would say, right, whereas that other fellow, right, I always thought you liked him much more than me. And he said, no. The other fellow has a yetzer hara to shmuz. So when he comes over to me, that's his yetzer tov trying to find a way to shmuz in Torah. But you, right, you could really learn. When you come over to me, it's your yetzer hara trying to shmuz instead of learning. So you, I turned away from, because otherwise you would learn. And him, I shmoozed with, because that was better. So that's, you know, really, it can be read as the way the book wanted you to read it, as this incredible knowledge the author had of the students, or it can be read as, oh my goodness, I don't really want to relate to my students with that lack of transparency. So I set out, right, so I critiqued the Musar movement, and I believe it's Rabbi Gottlieb and Professor Karmi, I don't remember, there are a bunch of car rides, and I don't have them straight in my head. Essentially challenged me, but of course you do want to change your students. So is there such a thing as is there a possibility of transparent transformative pedagogy? So I set out to set out a model class which was on Lashon Hara, and I had the students the first day tell me anonymously whether they were okay with the class being a class that was intended to affect behavior, as opposed to a class that was supposed to teach content, and they all agreed. And then, right, so I completely transformed the way I usually teach, which is usually all about information analysis. We used Joseph Telushkin's Words of Heal, Words of Harm as a textbook, and all the things that are about antithetical to me in the classroom, you know, journaling and talking about what you got right. It's really a very interesting experience. Very interesting experience. And one of the challenges was, really, what do you tell students about the relationship with their friends? Right? Do you tell students in your class that they have to become hermits? Because essentially, right, if you want people to keep a Lashon Hara journal, right, and you want them to say, I didn't hear any Lashon Hara this week, that probably meant locking themselves up in the room. Certainly not reading a newspaper. Right, so that was a very, and then of course, in good Benjamin Franklin mode, they had the problem that the better they got at Lashon Hara, the more difficulty they had maintaining their spiritual humility, because they felt much superior to all the gossips around them. Right, so that was a, right, that I think is a very serious challenge. So Benjamin Brown argues that what the Shemir Talashin should be read at is an example of aspirational morality. These are the things that ideally we think everyone would be doing, but as opposed to making them law, which is this is what everyone has to do now, we are much more tolerant of ourselves, not just societally. We're much more tolerant of ourselves when we fail. And I think that the argument is that really could be true of lots of other areas of halakha, and would force enable one to rethink many areas of halakha if you start thinking of them as these are the halakhot that we don't really expect anyone to fully keep, but we want everyone to want to fully keep. I think that all sorts of areas of halakha where it would be really interesting if that were the result. Okay, Pramachal, what did you want to say?
What do you think normal people talk about with their friends?
Pardon?
What do you think normal people talk about with their friends?
Normal people talk about their friends?
Yeah.
Friends.
Really? That sounds very boring.
Yeah, so some people, you could create like a family, let's say, right? A private society where people just talk about Torah.
Or you could just talk about, fictional characters. Or
fictional characters, that works too.
Or people who have clearly been Mofel their right to avoid Lashon Hara. I think that's what most people talk about. I think you could talk about sports. There's so many topics that aren't included in Lashon Hara that it's an example of aspirational morality. It seems like a very dim view of the world.
Okay, interesting claim. It seems to be a fairly good description of the social worlds that my students function in, based on their reports, but perhaps they all had very dim views of the world. I tried to make this argument, but they seemed fairly convinced that it was being very, very hard. Whether the experiment worked or not, but I always talk about this as like one of the unanswerable riddles of my life, where we finally dealt with it. Like the climactic moment for me was when a student was suspended from the school because of a drug issue, and then we had to go right, and the administration sent us into class to process, so he said, here as a class we will now test whether what we learned had any effect. We're going to have a Jewishly moral discussion of how this took place, and obviously what do you have to do? The first thing you have to do is decide if it's fair. In order to decide if it's fair, you have, right, obviously it makes a difference if it's a first offense or a previous, or not a first offense. In order to decide whether it's a first offense or not a first offense, you have to think of all the other bad things that the particular students might have done. Then you also have to know whether the administration treated them in the same way they treated other students. That requires you to review all the other cases in which students have done wrong things, in which the administration has punished them, and all this is inevitable, and I'm sitting there just tearing my hair out. And this class has just been working hard for months. Goes through this inevitable progression, and on the other hand, I couldn't, right, they were right, there wasn't any other way. If they want to be responsible members of a society, they have to evaluate the leaders, and the only way to evaluate the leaders is if they're fair. So, at the end, I asked the students, did you think this discussion had been different because of the class? And they all agreed that it had been completely different, and I could not tell the difference. So that is the outcome of that experiment. I still don't know. Because right, they're all sure that it made an enormous difference, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So I still have it was one of these honest educational papers where the result is, I don't know. Yeah, the result is a subjective impression on the part of the students that the class succeeded. Okay, so this is, I think that distinction is right, potentially really cool about lots of areas. Now, if you look at the way Fuller himself formulates it, and at least in the initial shallow presentation, so yes, Alicia.
I was just wondering if that something would not be enforceable.
It's not clear. It's not. it's not enforceable all the time. You know, it might be that it's enforceable if people, you know, egregiously break it. But not if they break it privately in their own homes on occasion. You can adjust, you can play with it. Right? You don't really react to people the same way. Right? When they don't live up to it. And you don't react to yourself the same way. And that may not relate to your issues of what you enforce and what you don't enforce. Pardon? It's probably not like really fairly enforceable. It's more like the thing which it might be beneficial for society if we set up traps so that one in 50 people who does this once in a while, right, gets punished and they pay their fine and it's okay. Sometimes there are certain things which is where it might be argued that it's good for a society to keep a lid on it. So we have a certain degree of enforcement, knowing that we're not going to catch everybody. Right, so that classically, that's what we did with prostitution, and gambling, and things like that, which are aspirational morality things. As a society, we aspire to have a society in which nobody gambles and there's no prostitution. But in practice, right, the job is to manage it. Okay, yes, Josh.
Can you apply the aspirational concept more to sort of the Torah? I mean, lashon hara is something that's just sort of derived and out.
I don't know. Chavetz Chaim's got lots of mitzvot in the Torah, but I think areas like, let's say, the desire to shield oneself from all erotic stimulation. Right? So you can imagine, right? You know, that's a religious ideal, but it's an aspirational ideal, right? We really don't want people to turn themselves into sense-deadened people. So on the one hand, right, so really the ideal is to be erotically aroused only in the context, right, only in the specific context of marital sexuality. But you can't be that kind, you can't really be that kind of person, right? That's not physically who human beings are, right? If you don't have switches that go on, that turn on and off that way in the vast majority of cases. So you figure out how to manage it. You don't, right? You try and limit your exposure, right? You try and move yourself out of situations. Right, which are dangerous, that kind of thing. We want there not to be machloket in the community. But we also want people to stand up for what's right. So we have the aspiration of a perfectly peaceful community. But it's not necessarily the most important thing. But in general, the community should be one where people get along and fights don't metastasize. I think there's a whole set of areas, that would work out, and then we can talk about which ones are and which ones aren't. Now, yes, Chaim?
Especially when you were comparing it to, like, sometimes catching people, right? Do you think that was a conscious motivator for the way that things were set up?
I don't know. We don't have, since we don't have enforcement, at all currently in the halakhic community, I would say that we do certainly, if we looked at the way we set up communal norms, so there's some things that we let people get away with in their houses, and there's some things, right, and there's some things that we're more machbit about what people do privately, and there's something, and I think that generally as a society, you put your enforcement efforts in different places, and then there's some things that sometimes people get caught, and when they get caught, everyone makes a big deal out of it, even though that lots of other people do the same stuff. And maybe that's hypocrisy, and maybe it's a decent social choice. I'm open to it. I'm open to it either way. I'm open to it either way in that, because I think we haven't thought enough about what it would be like to have to some extent with the people who do enforce things. We really dislike their priorities in those communities that have really, at least in modern Orthodox, we seem not to be happy with their priorities. And so our response is we're not going to enforce anything, at least formally. And then our issues often about enforcement are more about drawing identity boundaries and about what's really religiously important to people. Right? So if it came down to it, right, so probably we should probably be asked, like, what's most important for people spiritually, just on a level, right? It would probably have very little to do about gender roles in the synagogue. But on a communal boundary level, that's what we choose to enforce in some ways, because that's how we define identity as a community. I think that's not an unreasonable choice. Yes?
I'm trying to understand the morality of duty. I'm trying to think about it say, for something that is a little bit amorphous or can be amorphous, kabedet avicha and ve'etimecha.
Yeah.
Where does the duty end and
okay, excellent. Excellent question. And I thought about making that the primary thing, but I thought I'd done that too often, and I wasn't sure it would be productive. But kibud av ve'em is an excellent case where we're told you don't exhaust the mitzvah kibud av ve'em, even if when you see when your insane mother insists, you bow down, you get on all fours on the floor, and you let her climb down for a better by walking on you, or if she's on the beach. Right, so you crawl on her hands and knees so that she doesn't have to touch the beach, and that doesn't exhaust the mitzvah of kibud av ve'em. On the other hand, we're told that you have fulfilled the mitzvah of kibud av ve'em if you have given your parents, if you've given your desperately poor parents, as much food as an ordinary person would eat, even if they're still hungry. So, if you follow hilchos kibud av ve'em all the way, right, and you assume that all of this is duty, then you end up being highly vulnerable to abuse. And I think that's bad. When I taught Hilchot Kibud Av Ve'em in Gan, so a lot of it was about self-protection and the limits of Kibud Av Ve'em. And it's really interesting to see when you give kids the project, write Hilchot Kibud Av Ve'em in a way that you would teach with the next class, and you see which students emphasize the positive and which students emphasize the protections. That's often a tells you a lot about the relationship with their parents. Part of why it makes me uncomfortable in some way to do it that way. But I think that's exactly right. I think that when we confuse the legal part of Hilchot Kibud Av Ve'em with the aspirational part, we end up with very dangerous situations. Because you're not supposed to let your parents abuse you. Every time I give a public shiur in Hilchot Kibud Av Ve'em, somebody comes up to me afterwards and tells me that they were abused years ago and they've been nursing this grudge against halacha in their hearts all their life because their parents used Hilchot Kibud Av Ve'em as a weapon against them and said, if you don't do what I'm telling you to do, then you're going against what God said, and the shiur liberates them. Just about every time I give that shiur in a new location, somebody comes over and says that to me. And I think that's right.
How would you classify the same, or how would you deal with, say, Avraham argues with Ribbono Shel Olam about Mishpat Chinuch, but he says that Hashem wants to destroy Sodom.
Yeah.
In other words, Hillel is such a fucking proof to make sure that they don't do what they were saying. I mean, where Avraham was Hillel fulfilling a halachic obligation, how would you classify?
Well, Avraham is pre-halachic, and conversations with God don't relate to halacha in any way at all, so I don't need to deal with Avraham. Hillel is trying to make the society work.
Yeah, I know he's trying to make society work, but does he have an obligation to be with that king first of all to make society work?
So that depends on...
Is there a halachic obligation? Is it how you...
So that, that's the far afield, the question of what halachic what obligations devolve, what legal obligations devolve on those people who make the law. Right, the meta obligations, right? What are the obligations of poskim, the obligations of members of Sanhedrin? That's a good question. I don't think the issue is different in kind. I think it's the same kind of question. It just may be that there's a special set of obligations that devolve.
One question is what?
As individual people, right? Do you have an obligation when you see person X being mean to person Y, or when you see a society being structured in such a way so that there are hardworking people who nonetheless have to take charity? So what's your obligation? Is your obligation to transform the society? Do you have to actually go vote? Do you have to run for office? Right, the same kind, right? Or is it the obligation only incurred once you are in office? All those are perfectly reasonable. Okay, last thing I want to set out here in the last two pages of the source, you can read yourselves later. But I discovered as preparing the shiur, I'd actually written out parts of this years ago. So I figured I'd just give you the write-up, and then you can compare afterwards what I said tonight to what I thought 5 or 6 years ago. But then buy the book when it comes out, so you can... Right, you can see what's changed as a result. So the last thing I want to take out is the Rambam in Hilchot Deot. So Rambam in Hilchot Deot very famously talks about the middle path, right? That I think everyone knows, right? And everyone, the comparison, is it the same as the Aristotelian golden mean? Is it not the same as the Aristotelian golden mean? Is it a static equilibrium? Is it a dynamic equilibrium? You can have all the sorts of fun things reading that. To me, what is really powerful at the Rambam is that
He doesn't actually mandate the golden mean necessarily. He talks about there being two kinds of people. The two kinds of people are the chacham and the chassid. And the chacham, he says, always works on the intermediate intermediate path, which is equidistant from each extreme. And the chachamim, the first chachamim commanded that you should always be measuring and tailoring yourself to be an absolute centrist. Right? Centrist orthodoxy, absolutely. But then he says, there are people called the chassidim. And the chassidim do not do this at all. The chassidim deliberately tend towards one extreme or the other. So they tend to be exceedingly shafel ruach, which he translates gova lev and shafel ruach, so that, it's that high-heartedness and low-spiritedness. The problem is that high-hearted is not an English term, and low-spirited in America means depression as opposed to humility. So these are hard terms to translate, but really arrogance and humility are probably the best analogy. And it says the same holds from all the same traits. So here, if you pick it up five lines from the bottom, he says the first chassidim, right? So he has his chassidim rishonim and he has his chachamim rishonim. So the chassidim rishonim would tilt their traits from the intermediate path towards the two extreme, some traits towards the last extreme, and some towards the first extreme. This is what is meant by lifnim mishurat hadin. Lifnim mishurat hadin is to not walk the intermediate path, and to be a chassid rather than a chacham. And then, he says, we are commanded to walk in the intermediate paths. And this is what the scripture means by the right? But it says these are the tovim v'yasharim. So that's the same pasuk that Ramban quoted. V'asita tov v'yashar. The Ramban quotes it also. And then he says that's what v'halachta b'drachav means. V'halachta b'drachav means to act like the chacham. And yet he has the chassid. So what is there left for the chassid if the chacham is following in God's ways and we are commanded to act like the chacham? Why is the chassid a chassid and not a rasha? And we have to be careful here, right? He doesn't mean he has types of people, right? He says, who because they feel their nature going one way, they go to the other extreme to pull themselves back. Those are chachamim. Chassidim are people whose nature would be perfectly fine, it seems, right? They're not compensating. They're going with it, right? Their nature pulls them towards this extreme, and they go with it. So, it seems to me that Rambam is carving out a space, which he says that the halakha is the intermediate path, but then there is a wholly different way of experiencing religion. And that is the way of the chassid. The way of chassid is much more idiosyncratic. And his language about this is really like fascinatingly ambiguous and ambivalent, right? Because he refers to it as mishu midakdek al atzmo bioter, somebody who is more particular with himself. They are the chassid as opposed to chacham. It seems to me that it's at least possible to say that somehow in the Rambam, what he's trying to say is that we need to leave, that the distinction between these two types of experience is that there has to be space in religious experience for the chassid. So when we legislate, and this goes together with the other piece, when we legislate, we make everyone do what is good for most people most of the time. And we constrict the religious experience of others. So the goal is to make sure that the expansion of halakha does not restrict the variety of religious experiences to the point that people whose nature isn't to be intermediate, but people who have tendencies towards extremes that can be positive, are there's space left for them. Now, I think that there's a problem here, because I think what Rambam tells you is that no society could function if everyone were chassidim. A society needs universalizability, right? So the law has to be something that if everyone did it, the society could survive. So, for example, the law has to be, if there's a law, that everyone has a chiyuv of puravu. Right? Because if you have a society where everybody goes to the extreme and decides that they're going to be celibate, so that society dies out. It doesn't mean that there isn't room in a society for celibates. It just means that the law has to be that everybody has an obligation to procreate, and that one matters so much that we make it part of the law. And to be a celibate, you have to define yourself in some space outside the law, like Rabbi, like Ben Azai, right? Who's defined as so attached to Torah that he's onus, right? He's compelled, and so you can't hold him responsible for failing to procreate, right? So create a space outside the law for him, but the law has to be that. So it seems to me that that is another way to provide differences between halakha and non-halakha. That halakha are the things that is important enough that we make everyone do them, even though sometimes doing them is counterproductive for you. And non-halakha are the things that are really, really good for most people and you really have to do them, but we recognize that there's some people for whom that is not the right thing to do. And it's important enough to not do it. So that's a set of frameworks as to how you can define the difference between halakha and non-halakha. You can define it in terms of generally a need for autonomy. You can define it as creating space for particular people to do particular things. You can define it as recognizing the difference between the things that are practical in a society and the things that we want everyone to want to be. You can read Professor Fuller's actual distinction, which I think is somewhat sharper than that. And you can argue much less interesting things just about how practically we can't write everything down. Or God wanted to leave room for us, so He wrote the basic book so we could write the infinite commentaries. So there would be something for us to do. But those are much less interesting to me than the others. All right, as always, thank you very much for coming out and listening. And I will, I guess, look forward to seeing you again next summer. This again, although there may be opportunities during the year as well. Next Wednesday, Rabbi Jonathan Ziering is coming. Some of you may remember was here for 4 summers and has been giving a whole series of really fascinating shiurim for years now that are very much in the spirit of the kind of thing we do here. So I encourage everyone to come out next Wednesday night for him. If you really need to, I'll argue with him so we can have some entertainment as well. I'm sure I'll find something to disagree with, but it's always great to have him back. And thank you, Young Israel, again for hosting.